Portland Afoot's podcast this month is sponsored by SolarCity, our new clean energy partner. You've already put your smart energy lifestyle on the street. SolarCity wants to help you put it on your roof. If you've been thinking about solar for years, now is seriously the time. Solar power gives you clean energy for a lower price at a fixed cost. If it's right for your home, you can take advantage of the amazing state incentives that are actually decreasing as more and more people go solar, so it's in your interest to get ahead of that curve. And if that's not enough, if solar power turns out to be right for your home, your installation will also support Portland Afoot's reporting. So just go to pdx.be/solar to contact Roma. He's a great guy. Let him know we sent you. Thanks.
Well, I walked past just yesterday, and I couldn't bear that new mall no more. I can't expect you all to see it my way, but you may not know what was there before. And I want them to put back my old corner store. Well, I walk past just a...
Hello, and welcome to this month's episode of the Portland Afoot Commuting Podcast about buses, bikes, and low-car life in PDX. I'm Lillian, your producer.
And I'm Michael, Portland Afoot's editor. Each month, Lillian and I bring you three practical bits of news that matter to Portlanders who get around without a car.
And we give it to you in the time that it takes the average Portlander to get to work. This month we'll be talking about a process that takes much, much more time than getting to work, planning a major American metropolis. We'll be joined by special guest to talk about how Portland's comprehensive plan is going very slowly to make your commute better.
Or worse. And because it's the holidays, we'll talk about how we get around when low-car Portlanders emerge from our cocoon of safe and easy transportation and visit auto-dependent friends and family out of town. And I'll share a transit tip of the month.
And I will share some of my favorite things people said on TriMet.
And I'll read a funny story from the bus.
Enjoy listening.
Why I would feel sorrow, I now know. I smelled a ghost smell from the ground. That old wooden smell from the old corner store.
We'll be talking about planning in general, about planning the metropolis, about the comprehensive plan. And to talk about it, we're joined by Mr. Chris Smith.
Hello.
Thanks, Chris, for joining.
Yes. Chris, you're, we should say, a board member. You've been a board member of Portland Afoot's parent organization since it was started a few years ago. And you also are the proprietor of Portland Transport, and you're also a Portland Planning Commissioner, Planning Sustainability Commissioner. And you do all kinds of things. I feel like you're the perfect example of the fact that somebody who's like strategic and persistent can get a lot of stuff done in this town just by working hard.
Being stubborn.
And being stubborn. That's right. Yeah. I mean, you're like us. You're not a lifer. You came in and decided you wanted to change the place.
Right. I have a day job besides this.
That's true too. Right. Anyway, so we're hoping that, and you'd wanted to talk about the comprehensive plan and why it's important, and we've sort of dreaded, like I think all journalists dread, uttering the phrase comprehensive plan. But I Googled comprehensive plan, and of course the second hit was the Portland comprehensive plan. And then I told Google that I was in New York City. And then I told Google that I was in Toledo, Ohio. And the Portland comprehensive plan was no lower than the fifth of the option. So the Portland comprehensive plan is in some, it must be the like the platonic comprehensive plan. Is what I decided, and you're on
or
the commission.
It's just that, like, Portland is one of the few cities that Googles comprehensive plan enough.
Maybe that's
or
true.
People link back to it from their website, pushing it up in Google search results.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. This is the collective.
It doesn't necessarily
wisdom.
Mean it's a platonic comprehensive plan.
I attribute everything, all wisdom to humanity, really, and Google does too. And humanity attributes all wisdom about comprehensive planning to Chris and his colleagues. So we are asking Chris to talk to us about comprehensive planning and why commuters should care about it.
Okay. Well, let me put it in context a little bit. You know, as an activist, I run into lots of people who are concerned about specific projects. You know, somebody's building a six-story apartment building in your neighborhood. You don't like it. And what do you do about that? There are local approval criteria that have to be met, and that can be an opportunity for activists. But a lot of times, things like that can get built, quote-unquote, by right, because the plan, the you know, the controlling plans allow that to happen. And the challenge is that activists are seldom paying attention when these long-term planning efforts are being being made.
So these are efforts that are, the city is saying such and such land can be used for this purpose,
right?
Basically?
Right. And we're required to do that by state law. Oregon's land use statutes require all cities to do this about every 20 years or so. We're probably about 10 years late, but part of that is because we've been very deliberate about this, going through first the Portland plan process, which was kind of the big strategic visionary plan for what do we want to look like as a community. The comprehensive plan, or comp plan as we say for short, is the way we actually encode that in law. And it will not only capture the strategies of the Portland plan, but it will also roll up all those other plans that we've done since the last time we did this. So, for example, we passed the Bicycle Master Plan. Well, when that got passed, it got passed by resolution of council. So council said, yeah, this is a great idea.
This is the map of where all the bike corridors should be, and like and this street should be better for bikes than that street, and so on.
And the
Which
set of
a lot of cities have, but very few cities actually follow, is what I've
kind of gleaned. Following it is really where the comp plan comes into play, because you know council passed that as a resolution saying, we think this is a good idea, and we'll put it in the stack with all the other good ideas. That doesn't make it law. It means that, you know, if staff is making decisions, sure, they can look at that and balance it with other things. The comp plan, which would be passed as an ordinance, a law of the city, as opposed to a resolution, you know, we like this, will make some of those policies law. Now, in doing that, we have to look at the other plans that have been passed. For example, there's a freight master plan that got passed. And you could be sure that there are policies in the freight master plan that conflict with policies in the bicycle master plan, and we're going to have to sort that out and come up with policies that balance that. But then they get turned into law, which means that when the traffic engineer goes to design the street, he has to follow the law. So this is really important in setting the way Portland's going to develop the next 20 years. And if we're looking to shift from an auto-dominant paradigm to an active transportation-dominant paradigm, this is our moment to get as much of that policy as possible encoded into law. So that's why it's really important.
Could you have, like, cite an example of something that, some law that would have trade-offs involving buses or bikes that road engineer would have to be governed by?
So one of my favorites is the so-called level of service policy, LOS, and it's basically the way that we measure how our streets perform. So every intersection, we look at it and we can analyze a level of service, which is really about how congested it becomes. And it's about, you know, how many cars we can move through that intersection at, you know, the peak hour, which is usually the p.m., afternoon peak.
So the street is 80 feet wide, so it can fit
6,000
cars
many lanes,
over 1 hour.
And you have these kind of turn configurations, and all those things can go into a model, and they come out with a level of service. And it's typically, you know, A, which is what the engineers will tell you is what you get when you build the streets before you build the houses, down through F, which basically says, you know, things aren't moving.
What's the F-most street?
There's a lot of F streets.
Yeah, we have a lot of them. I mean, the whole inner freeway loop is allowed to be F for an hour in the afternoon. And we said by policy we will accept that amount.
That is what it feels when I try to drive through it.
Right. And it's because you really don't want to design something that's going to be around 7x24 for, you know,
for 1 hour.
1 hour a day.
Yeah.
The 5% of its life where it's going to be congested.
Unless you're a shopping mall.
Unless you're a shopping mall, you have to design for Black Friday.
Right.
But level service measures motor vehicles. It doesn't talk about how many people get through that intersection on a bus, on a bicycle, on foot, on a Segway, whatever. It just talks about motor vehicles. So we have a policy that basically says traffic engineers will design our streets to accommodate automobiles, and everything else is nice if you can fit it in. Well, I think it's time to turn that around. I'm hoping we'll come up with a level of service policy that will talk about how much mobility we provide for people or goods and services, because we do have to move freight through as well. Talk about the economic value of things that are moving in trucks. Great, let's include that. But, you know, counting engines and wheels is not what's going to get us to a good society, so this is, you know, our opportunity to fix that. As one example.
But isn't LOS a federal's, I mean, it's an FHWA standard, like Federal Highway Administration standard, right? Is there ways
that
we...
This is when Lily is showing off.
Really? I guess I'm just curious, like, how we're able as a city to not have to bend to the FHWA for a level of service things when...
Well, so it depends on the context. They're on the freeway network, we probably have to.
Okay.
But when we're designing local streets, that's not necessarily the case. So the, you know, the federal jurisdiction only goes so far. Sometimes you take federal money, some of those things come along with it, but there are a lot of things where we have discretion. You know, I think a recent example that comes to mind for me is the Williams Avenue safety bike lane project. You know, at the end, the traffic engineers came in and said, basically, well, there's this one stretch where we don't think we can get rid of the auto lane. We have to do a shared lane. I am certain that if they were not required to meet a motor vehicle LOS standard, they would not have had to make that judgment. So that's where, you know, the policy hits the road and we get different designs.
So they on Williams Avenue, they've got a mandate that says in order to have this level, the C level or whatever it was. Right.
We then should define Williams Avenue for our non-Portland listeners.
Good point.
So North Williams is a very high bicycle traffic corridor that has a kind of extra wide bike lane on it. But I don't know what the peak volume of cyclists on there is, but I know
it's
when you're
in it.
It's
the highest in the city.
Right? Yeah, it's definitely the highest in the city, and it definitely feels like you're, I mean, it feels like you're in traffic when you're there in rush hour.
Bicycle congestion.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I mean, it's beautiful, but it's also, it's actually gotten to the point, it's also a bus corridor, so it's gotten to the point where it's, there's just sort of conflicts with different levels of speed of cyclists and everything.
And the code that says this is what kind of a street it is, this is the level of congestion on the street, it just looks at the number of cars.
Right.
So it's saying, like, well, there are 6,000 cars an hour, but it's, it, then there are also, like, 1,000 bicyclists an hour.
Right.
And that doesn't count that at all as part of the good that the street is doing. So if you try and improve things for the bike so you can get to 1,500 bicyclists and you lose 500 cars, that's the same number of people, but...
Well, and I think part of the issue here, too, is that we don't have... We have plenty. We have safety standards out the wazoo for cars for level of service. We know what makes a safe road for cars. And, you know, in theory, we traffic engineers have been studying this for 50 years. But we don't really have a good sense in the United States of safety standards for cyclists, and we're unwilling to make the massive infrastructure jumps that we would need to make to have, you know, fully separated bike paths that we see have highly successful safety rates in the Netherlands. So what we end up with is we know how to meet the safety standards for cars, but we just, it's sort of this weird gray box that we're entering into with cyclists, because there's just, it's, North Williams is pretty much unprecedented in the United States. It's probably one of, I bet Davis maybe has higher bike congestion during peak hours, but.
Right. Yeah. You probably have to go to a place like Copenhagen to see something.
Right.
On the same scale. And, you know, we are, you know, it's a learning experience because bicycling at this level is really relatively new in the United States. So we're learning from Europe, we're learning from other places. But you're right. It has been FHWA and things like the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, which is produced by the highway engineers that have governed this. You know, there are efforts to reform that. So we now have NACTO, which is the something of city transportation officials. So it's more of an urban-oriented organization, and they're producing their own guidelines and kind of try to compete with that. So LOS is one element of the comp plan that I think is going to be really important for active transportation. It's just one policy out of many. I think that another big question is, as Portland grows, where are we going to funnel that growth? What parts of the city do we want to see experience that growth? And that will shape the urban form that, you know, will, you know, be either good or bad for people who want to walk, cycle, use other forms of active transportation. So one of the strategies from the Portland plan.
Can you explain to us, like, where Metro ends and where the comp plan and the planning commission begin? Metro, right? They're one of their main things is managing growth for Portland.
Right.
But
Metro is the regional government. Portland's the city government. They're both planning for growth.
And then the county governments at the edges.
Right.
Yeah, as well.
Sorry, county.
So Metro really looks at, you know, the regional picture and says how much will the tri-county area grow given period of time, and they worry about how much land to bring into the urban growth boundary. Now, Portland has very little land that's not already in the urban growth boundary. It's a little bit in Forest Park, but in general, we're already all inside the urban growth boundary. So Metro comes up with forecasts of how many new people and how many new jobs are going to show up in each city. And
20 years from now, Portland's going to be 30% bigger.
Right.
Something like that. I don't remember the number
off the top of my head, but yeah, I mean, there'd be this many households and this many more jobs in Portland. It's then up to the city when there's some negotiation between Metro and the cities about that. So some city may say, well, we don't think so. We think ours should be less. And Portland in general has been aggressive about taking growth because we want to maintain our role as, you know, the vibrant central hub in the region. So, and in general, we have performed better on infill housing development. So we typically exceed Metro's forecast. So Metro will come up with a number and we'll actually have more housing. Jobs are still tending to go to the edges, which is a bit of a problem. So that's sort of where Metro comes in. So they're setting sort of the targets. We get to figure out how. And you know, one of the goals from the Portland plan is the healthy connected city policy, which includes the idea of 20-minute neighborhoods, although that particular term doesn't seem to have gotten a lot of traction. But the idea that you want to have clusters of housing and services and jobs so people can get to things in relatively short trips, as opposed to, you know, having to go from a bedroom community over here to a job center over here to a retail center over there. You want to cluster all those in a set of centers around the city.
I feel like that's, I don't know if I'm right about this, but I feel like that's like the most unique thing about Portland compared to the other places I've lived is the number, you know, at our density, the number of little retail corners that have like seven shops on them scattered through the east side.
Right. I think that's an attribute of the history of Portland, which was a you know, early 20th century streetcar city. So those things built up around a streetcar network. So once you get past 82nd Avenue, you don't see those anymore.
No, right.
Right? Or you don't see them in Southwest Portland, which were the, you know, the post-war in suburbs that got incorporated,
right,
and have a very different feel. So one of the challenges is how do we get that kind of pattern out past 82nd? Because the Portland plan says that something like 80% of the population should live within, you know, 20 minutes of one of these centers, and we don't. Mm-hmm. So there are several ways to do that. We could try and create more of those centers, and we're sort of trying to do that a little bit on 122nd, where we've introduced more commercial zoning to try and get, you know, more of those neighborhood retail services to spring up. We could look at just making the existing centers denser so things can get bigger and taller. We could look at focusing more of the growth close to the central city where a lot of those services exist. So just say, okay, let's not put any more people past 82nd. Let's put them all, you know, inside. And that has its own consequences, and we probably won't do that. There'll be some mixture of those policies. But, you know, the primary approach for mobility is let's put a lot of that growth along transit corridors. So where we've places where we've got frequent transit, we have the ability for people to get mobility. Doesn't always mean we have a good bicycle network.
So do you just wave your magic
sidewalks.
Density wand? Do you just wave the magic planning commission density wand at transit corridors?
Sprinkle the density dust around.
Is it zoning? Is that the main way that you're able to do it? Or is it also incentives like we saw in the Pearl where they, you know, we really lured in developers with tax benefits?
It's a combination of zoning, so what we allow, including, in some cases, the minimum of what we allow, so you can't develop something smaller than X. It's where we invest in public infrastructure. So, for example, the Pearl, the streetcar, was a big investment, tearing down the Lovejoy ramp, so you had an at-grade street system, which is now kind of the heart of the Pearl on Lovejoy. You know, that just used to be a ramp going over all that stuff before. And then there are some incentives involved, although I would say that the tax incentives are, in most cases, the icing on the cake, and it's the zoning and infrastructure investments that are the core of the policy.
Yeah. Yes or no?
So is this a build transit and they will come? Is that a lot of the sort of...
Well, it's clearly not that simple. I mean, you have to have the transit, you have to have the right zoning along the transit lines, you have to have, you know, the sewers and the water lines and, you know, the broadband internet connections. You really have to put everything together in a package. But the idea is let's put the growth on those transit corridors rather than trying to do, you know, infill inside the single family neighborhoods, right? I mean, that would, politically, that would not make a lot of Portlanders happy, I'm sure. And practically, it would be harder to bring infrastructure. So if you dumped a 6-story apartment building in the middle of some single family neighborhood, those people are going to have a much harder time getting to transit and not being car dependent. So it furthers our other goals as well. But it does then mean that we have areas experiencing change, like we're seeing on Division right now, where a couple of developers have sort of seized on a pattern of relatively low land values and available on-street parking and are doing a bunch of apartment buildings, and the neighbors are seeing very rapid change, and obviously that upsets some people.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that in terms of level of service, that we talked about sort of about two things. So you're saying on level of service, you think that the city needs to be recognizing the fact that bikes and buses and pedestrians are also moving value up and down a street.
Right.
And on neighborhood centers and managing growth, do you have a core message you think that people should take away?
Well, I think for the low car part of the population, the idea is that as we concentrate more of the services in these centers, they're going to be easier to reach. So you'll be able to get, more stuff inside your personal bike shed, right? The distance you're comfortable walking or biking. And the LOS policy will make it a lot easier for the transportation folks to design facilities that are better for cycling. The trade-offs they have to make, the compromises to accommodate cars, will be greatly reduced.
So that increases our ability to have more of these centers mm-hmm. in the relatively denser parts
right.
of the city?
Right.
I'm still in love with this whole LOS changing idea, but I'm curious if this is something that we can export. If we're able to package some sort of multimodal LOS mm-hmm. methodology, are we able to package that up and ship it off to other cities?
There'll be a lot of cities watching what we do, absolutely.
Yeah. Does anybody else have an LOS that incorporates active transportation?
Not that I know of. Certainly not in North America, as far as I know.
Wow.
Right. So I do want to make sure people know how to get involved in this.
Great.
So, we had an extensive public involvement process during the Portland
If that discussion wasn't too wonky for you, then...
This is for you.
Right. So right now, we have a bunch of what are called PEGs, policy expert groups, working on different topic areas in the comp plan. And staff will be producing a rough draft before Christmas, and then a sort of more polished draft early in 2013. And then there will be a round of public open houses and community participation to help us refine that. So people should be planning to pay attention to this in the spring, because the project you hate in 15 years will be decided by policies that we do this spring. So,
and then they'll say, you should have been there in 2013.
And I'll say, and I told you.
That's great. Great.
For our couple hundred Portland podcast listeners.
Can I ask you one last question on this?
Sure.
I want your insider tips on which parts of Portland are going to be the awesomest in the future due to your string pulling.
I think the...
that are not awesome right now, or less awesome than they will be.
Yeah, I think the inner east side and inner northeast will just continue to get awesomer and awesomer. I think that there's no way the patterns don't support that.
And Chris is not biased because he does not live...
I'm a west sider, so...
Yes. Yeah, weird. You may be our first west side guest, Chris. Congratulations. Moving along.
Oh, this is a much more depressing topic than the comp plan, I feel like.
Holidays?
Holiday transportation.
I don't know. Chris, when was the last time you left town for the holidays?
Been a long, long time, because I'm part of a blended family, so the kids are always going back and forth between households on Christmas.
Right.
We're both from Ohio originally, but although you don't go back to Ohio anymore for
holidays. But I do go to the outside rim of the Seattle metro area in one direction or another, so... I was just there last weekend, actually, for Thanksgiving, and I visited my sister's beautiful new home in the far, far suburbs of Seattle, from my perspective, and it was amazing to see exactly the trade-off that she had made. My sister used to say, I could only ever live in New York City, it's the only real city in the country, and now she says, but I want a couple of dogs, and I just can't do that in the city. Anyway, so my question is,
economics the bid rent function.
All right. So when we're visiting somebody who's chosen a different equation or a different outcome of the bid rent function, what do we do? I'm curious about the lifestyle that you guys try to. How much do you meld yourselves into a car dependent lifestyle when you're visiting elsewhere, and how much do you try to export your own righteous ease of transportation?
It's always a strange mix for me, because I had an interesting time this summer where I was back in Cincinnati for the first time, where I absolutely was dependent on cars pretty much because I had broken my wrist.
Right.
And here I was getting around on a trike, but trikes don't fly terribly well, so I wasn't able to stick it on the plane. Even Amtrak won't take the trike.
We're going
to
be sponsored by a folding trike someday.
Oh my god. There is one, actually, but it's really expensive. Mm. And still, I think, not, like, checked baggage size. Yeah, so I didn't know anybody that had a trike in Cincinnati, which is also incredibly hilly. I don't know if I could have done it on a trike. And the bus system in Cincinnati, which I cannot believe I got around on when I was a teenager before I started biking, is appalling. There's not even signs that mark the stops. They just paint an orange stripe around a pole. It doesn't tell you which way the bus is coming or going, like, mm-hmm. what route is there. There's no transit tracker.
Yeah.
Imagine life without transit tracker.
No, it would be terrible. And it is. Yeah.
When I go back home to visit my dad, who lives in a city of about 50,000 people in western Massachusetts, I am, like, instantly back in auto-dependent mode. You know, it starts with renting a car at the airport because the airport's an hour away from the town where I grew up, and I'm there with the rental car, and the transit system doesn't serve where my dad lives. And, yeah, I can get to the kind of the downtown, which is still very traditional small town downtown feel, which is great, and walk around there, but beyond that, everything's auto dependent.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Does that feel like you're returning to, do you feel guilty about that? Does it feel unnatural? Does it feel natural and you're like, oh, here, this is the person I was when I was more auto dependent?
I think I do it so seldom that it's just a practical accommodation to necessity. But yeah, I've thought about, okay, could I rent a bike for the week? Yeah, he doesn't live on the...
What would your dad say about that?
Oh, he'd be fine with that. And I've done that in the past when I've gone back there on a few occasions. Well, actually, I think I brought a bike with me on one trip because I actually bicycled from Pittsfield, which is far western Massachusetts, to Boston. But that was a lot of years ago. The street he lives on now is a narrow two-lane road with high speed traffic and no sidewalks. It would be, I could probably do it. I'm confident enough to try it, but it wouldn't feel very comfortable. I do, through some of the people I follow on Twitter, it seems like a lot of people find the folding bike really practical for intercity travel, either by throwing on an Amtrak or just checking on the plane and then having a way to get around when you get there.
For me, it just, because I'm not the kind of person that's going to rent a car just because I drive so infrequently, driving in another city is terrifying to me. So, like, I'm going to be transit dependent when I'm in another city regardless. The folding bike is nice because even if I don't use it in with the frequency I use a bike in Portland, mm-hmm. it's like it's that extra mile thing sometimes where... Because I actually go down to L.A. a lot, and that's been... really helpful when I've been in LA, where I've been like, the transit's pretty good in LA. Like, it gets, LA gets a bad rap. But when I'm staying in West LA and I have to go to Hollywood for a conference and it's an hour on their bus rapid transit system, which is not a bus rapid transit system, like, being able to do part of it on the bike is really nice. Spinlister is a peer-to-peer bike sharing.
It's like the get around of bikes.
Yeah. Right? Oh, they changed their name though. Now they're Liquid or something. Yeah. There's some startup that changed your name. It's very annoying. Spinlister was a great name. I don't know what the problem was. But you can rent other people's bikes, which is nice in terms of, like, you're probably going to get a better rate. And for me, being a small woman, it's hard often for me to find a bike that fits me. But being able to not just pick from the two stock bikes at the one place that rents bikes in town is really helpful. So
has anybody traveled recently to cities that have bike share systems?
Never. I have not.
No, I'm going to D.C. in March, so...
Oh, cool.
There's...
Let us know how that goes.
Yeah.
I think I'm bringing a foldy out, though. But I will definitely be giving it a shot. When I was in Europe, I was traveling in cities with bike share systems, but mostly I wasn't able to use them because I didn't have a European credit card. So you can't use Walib without a European credit card, so I only got to do a short trek on one when I, like, got a friend to check it out for me that lived in Paris.
That's my plan is that when my family visits me, they're going to get on the bike share here... And that's how I'm going to get them used to the idea of me getting around when I go to visit them without the car, eventually. That's my plan.
My mom came to visit and had broken her wrist, and we just got a Bach Fiat's from Clever Cycles, and I hauled her around in the Bach Fiat's.
Oh, that's
yeah.
great. That would definitely sell my mom on biking, too.
It was a little scary when I had to park it, though, because having a full-sized adult in the front of a Bakvia, it does not make for an easy parking job.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Is that it?
I think that's everything? That's our topics. That's our news.
Do you have a low-car tip of the month for us, Michael?
I do.
Was that our low-car tip of the month?
I guess
whole holiday be, section.
Right. Put your money in the box. If you have your own thoughts, of course, write us in at podcast@portlandfoot.org, and we'll share your thoughts on
rollerblades.
On rollerblades, yeah. No, here's the tip of the month. It's cold. It's getting colder, and it's time for your feet to be cold. So when you're on the max, that there's nice, beautiful heat in there. The bus heat is much more sporadic, but here's the trick. You get brilliant, wonderful, radiant heat in two seats on the bus, and those are the ones right next to the back door. You know, there's a foot heater underneath the seat right by the back door of each bus. And on the new buses, here's the special tip, there's also one across from that. So that's not next to the door anymore. If you want the radiant heat for your feet, sit across in the new buses that have the big windows. You'll see them. They look like UFOs. And you can sit across from the back door, and there's a heater there that will keep your feet toasty. That is your tip of the month this month.
And if you're taking a bus in Southwest Portland, you will never get foot heaters.
They're all at the...
Because they're they're really old because they have to have the tiny buses to...
Right.
As I discovered when I had to take the buses up to Lewis and Clark. Buses are changing.
I think they're still changing. I think they're shifting those out even so, aren't they?
I don't know. The bus drivers apparently like them because they're all snappy to drive.
You want to read some tweets?
Yes, I would like to read some tweets. There was a lot of very clever tweeting going on, particularly once the car crashed into the Max Tunnel.
Oh, yeah.
And completely upset Portland's transit system.
Yeah, the guy with like $30,000 in his pocket or something.
Having
a good night for a while.
Yeah, going the wrong way down the Max Tunnel in a car.
Yeah.
So now that the rain has settled in, Max Fax tweets, ancient TriMet proverb, a ticket vending machine is no match for one wet dollar bill. TriMet Cares, which I should say again, is a parody account. It's not actually TriMet. Bicycles are allowed on the Max. Children can even sit in our seats. Your dog can even stand in the aisle. But please, no cars in the tunnel. Bonnie Hildebrandt, who's bike vegan on Twitter, says, guy next to me on Max complaining about having a girlfriend sucks. Because it doesn't give him time to play Bioshock 2. Hashtag loser. Awkward TriMet, which is a new account I recommend following. Not sure why people write in their journals on the bus. If you think I won't read over your shoulder, you're wrong. PDX TriMet writer tweets, it's the driver with stickers on his transfer. Yay! The first driver I ever rode the 67 with. This guy is awesome.
That actually brings us to our story. Which is also a bus through Southwest. It's our only on the bus story this month is by a fellow named Tyler. And this is actually the director's cut version. I couldn't bear to cut it anymore, but I'm going to have to figure out how to get it in print. But anyway, this is the slightly version that wouldn't quite fit on the freaking page. Here we go. Here's what Tyler says. He's a rider on the 45. I started riding the bus probably a year ago. It's funny, there are so many people on the bus that we see every day, and I don't know their names, but I definitely know them. They always get off at the same stop, you know? This woman and I get off at the same bus stop. We lived in the same complex, and she would always beat me home. I don't know how she would do it. I would be so pissed. How'd she get, like, 20 feet ahead of me? I would run through the Dairy Queen. We'd be, like, speedwalking to and from the bus. She's 10 years older than me, shorter, round in the face, dark hair, very fashionable. She likes to wear an owl ring. You know how you usually see people like, oh no, I made eye contact, quickly, shift away. It went on like that for a good 3 months. I'm gay, and two gay guys at the front of the bus and I were looking at each other like, I think you're part of my team. And there's this one guy that they were friends with that I wanted to be friends with. He's just super extroverted, totally willing to talk to anybody. If you're sitting close enough, he's going to talk to you or about you at some point. So eventually, the four of us started talking. In the beginning, almost all of us had like one headphone in, but you could tell the woman was always listening. So finally I said, it's okay to laugh. This is a stupid conversation, you know? So now it's the five of us. We almost always commandeer the back few seats. I almost always sit next to the left side of the bus. Carolyn sits across from me. John sits in the corner next to Carolyn. And then Scott and Kirk sit next to each other in the middle. After a few months of that, we started to go to the bar together on Fridays. I'm 26. Carolyn's 36. I think John is just a month younger than Carolyn. Scott and Kirk are partners, probably early 50s. They're married. I think they even work in the same company. The fact that we're still allowed on the 45, I think, is amazing. Like, last night, we started talking about how we like our eggnog thick. How it's just totally sacrilegious to mix it with anything else, except maybe brandy. Kirk said, oh, I love it when you get so thick that you get it stuck in the back of your throat. And I said, oh, I love it so thick you gotta swallow twice. And then Carolyn looks at me and goes, we are still talking about eggnog, right? And then the whole bus started laughing. And I turned bright red, because this is a very inappropriate conversation all of a sudden. It's our first Thanksgiving and Christmas together. We're called the 430 group, I believe. If you're on the 45 and you sit by us, we'll probably talk to you. If you want to talk, talk. If it's going to be silly, we might laugh at you.
That was great.
Yeah, well, that was a great holiday story.
And that's our show. That was a good note to end on. You can subscribe to the show at pdx.be/podcast and send us any comments you have at podcast@portlandafoot. And thank you, Chris, for joining.
Yes, thanks so much. You can spread the word about the show by searching for Portland Afoot on iTunes and leaving a review. And you can sign up for our forthcoming mobile phone magazine at portlandafoot.org.
You can follow me at Anomaly on Twitter.
And I'm at ChrisSmithUS.
And you can follow Portland Afoot on Twitter and Facebook, too. I'm Michael Anderson, your editor.
And I'm Lillian Kerbake, your producer. Thanks for listening, and remember to exit through the back.
Pass on the left.
And don't forget to thank your bus driver.
Got to stop, and I want them to put back that old corner store. Bom-a-nim-a-nim-a-nim-a-way-o, bom-a-nim-a-nim-a-way-o-webo, bom-a-nim-a-nim-a-no, corner store, corner store.